On the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton is promising to deploy half a billion solar panels by the end of her first term in office. Bernie Sanders says climate change is a moral issue. Donald Trump, well, this week, physicist Stephen Hawking called Trump a demagogue, but he went on to say a bigger threat to the U.S. is global warming, which Trump has said he doesn't believe in, although his golf club in Ireland is requesting to bypass a rule and build a big wall to deflect against high seas caused by climate change. So each candidate has had something to say, but none are asking Americans to conserve. And it's maybe because they remember President Jimmy Carter. He took office in 1977 during one of the coldest winters in American history. There was also an energy crisis because the U.S. was running out of its own oil to pump, and it couldn't import because oil-producing Arab nations launched an embargo after the U.S. backed Israel in the Yom Kippur War. In his first speech, Carter wore a cardigan in front of a fireplace and asked Americans to conserve.
But if we all cooperate and make modest sacrifices, if we learn to live thriftily and remember the importance of helping our neighbors, then we can find ways to adjust and to make our society more efficient and our own lives more enjoyable and productive.
Carter installed solar panels on the White House. He created the Department of Energy. In turn, he received a big, fat raspberry from Americans. Meg Jacobs teaches history and public affairs at Princeton. She writes about all this in her new book, Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. Meg, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Boy, we have got to flesh out what it was like in the 70s, because it occurs to us this would be like talking to someone in the 70s about something that happened in the 30s and 40s. You know, it is so ancient history to many people. How bad did it get? I mean, people were killed on lines trying to pump gas.
It got bad, and there was a sense of chaos. There was a sense that America, as the country had known it, was coming to an end. And this led to a frantic rush to the pumps to tank up wherever possible. And people were carrying around a month's supply of gasoline in their tanks rather than tanks in the ground, which, of course, made the shortage worse. And as you say, this led to heightened tensions on the gas lines. There were fistfights. There were even in a couple cases murders. One man stabbed another to death in front of his pregnant wife.
Yeah, and 10 days later, you write in The Atlantic, another man was stabbed to death because, as a police officer said, well, there was a shorter line and they both were trying to get in it. And there you go. You also had thousands of truckers tying up bridges and highways, 12-mile backup for 7 hours in one case, shutdown of the Ohio Turnpike because they were protesting the lack of gas. In another case, there was a bumper sticker, Carter, Kiss My Gas. There were popular songs that were written.
Yes, there were songs written that captured the sense of this real tension. The Southern oil producers claimed that they could solve the energy crisis if those northern liberals got out of their way and got rid of all of the regulations on the industry. And a popular song coming out of Texas was called Freeze a Yankee.
Freeze a Yankee, drive 75 and freeze them alive. Freeze a Yankee, let your thermostat rise and give them a surprise. Governor Briscoe.
Okay, well, there you have it. Meanwhile, Jimmy Carter keeps asking people, you know, turn down your thermostats. He was asking people to conserve. Was it him, you know, the man himself who couldn't deliver the message? Was it, you know, the idea that people were outraged that government was trying to deliver the message? What was happening?
I think it was the message itself. The message itself, it's not something common that we hear presidents appealing to Americans to cut back, to live in a more thrifty fashion, to conserve. And Jimmy Carter was quite courageous in tackling the problem head on. He appeared in a cardigan sweater a couple weeks into office and said, frankly, to the American people that their lives were going to have to change, that they were going to have to dial down their thermostats, they were going to have to carpool, they were going to have to use mass transit, and they were going to have to fundamentally rethink the way that they had lived a life of abundance throughout much of the post-war years. And then he made this appeal once again in the summer of 1979 when there were mile-long gas lines. He went on national television and appealed to Americans again to cut back. And this was at a time when Americans were literally rioting shooting at the gas pumps in Levittown, Pennsylvania. There was a gas riot where local citizens set two cars on fire and paraded around with signs that said, more gas, more gas. So the intentions and the desires of Americans were quite clear.
Let's listen to a little bit of that speech, July 15th, 1979.
Take no unnecessary trips. To use carpools or public transportation whenever you can. To park your car one extra day per week. To obey the speed limit. And to set your thermostats to save fuel.
And when he says obey the speed limit, it was set to 55 to try to get people to slow down. Look, he obviously failed miserably, lost his reelection bid to Ronald Reagan. There was also the Iran hostage crisis. What happened then?
Well, when Ronald Reagan runs in 1980, he's able to use the energy crisis and the gas lines and the shortages as exhibit A for why government has failed and why government as a whole is not the solution to our national problems. And he is able to capitalize on the sense of frustration that Washington can no longer provide. And he wins in a landslide, and out goes conservation, and in comes a president who is much more of a champion of full-on production. It's an early version of drill, baby, drill. And when we are not able to supply enough of our own fuel, Reagan calls for a greater military presence in the Persian Gulf, and that will culminate ultimately in the Gulf War in 1991.
Well, you can actually track some of these changes. Smaller Japanese cars, which people had started to go towards, you write, they were all the rage in the 70s, were replaced by bigger gas guzzlers. There was a new hit song. Let's listen to a little of Sammy Hagar's I Can't Drive 55. Ronald Reagan also takes down the White House solar panels, and the Republican-led government starts to work more on deregulation.
Yes. One of the things that Ronald Reagan promises in the Republican Party platform is to repeal the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit, which seemed to embody, which really seemed the most egregious sign of this age of limits that Carter had espoused. Americans hated the speed limit, and Reagan works hard to get it repealed. And it's something that resonates with the public who does not want, they do not want to be told to slow down, to cut back. And Reagan says the way to a more abundant future is to get rid of all kinds of regulations on the energy industry, from environmental regulations to price controls. And the very first thing he does when he comes into office is, through executive order, repeal all of the price controls and allocation measures that were in place throughout the 1970s.
Well, so now here we are in 2016. We have another presidential race. You say we are at another crossroads, and a lot of people would agree with you that when it comes to climate change in particular, something has to be done. But we also have a Congress that research shows a huge number of them are climate deniers. We have people who think that, well, look, we've got natural gas and fracking. We also have facts like this was astonishing. In 2015, more people got jobs in solar and wind than in the oil industry, and employment in renewables was three times greater than in coal. But we just saw how this played out on the campaign trail. Hillary Clinton lost because of coal workers who, you know, Donald Trump is promising them that he'll bring their jobs back.
It's a difficult issue. It's a very divisive issue. And I think one of the lasting legacies of the energy crisis and the failure to solve it in the 70s was the way in which it undercut confidence in government to solve any of our problems. So if Watergate and Vietnam taught us that our presidents lie or we can't trust them, then the energy crisis taught Americans that government didn't work. And that was one of the lasting legacies, which I believe today makes it difficult for us to make arguments that government can play an effective role as we transition to a new energy economy.
You know, I'm thinking of one thing, though, California, which might be an example. You know, it asked the state, it asked people to conserve. And one of the first concerns was, well, do you mean everyone? You know, are the wealthier towns going to be able to get away with not participating? And they made it clear that it was going to be across the board. It feels like you have to tap into that anxiety too, right? That there will be a class distinction of some sort and make sure that there isn't.
Yes, for sure. And we see this on a global scale too, right, with the Paris Agreement. So how much will the United States as a whole have to sacrifice given its outsized contribution to emissions? How much will the United States relative to other countries have to be asked to cut back? Yeah. So you see this both locally, state by state, and then even internationally.
Well, meanwhile, Meg Jacobs, in 2016, people are talking about unease at some of the anger they're seeing at rallies and on the left and the right. Boy, we're reminded by your book, they ain't seen nothing, you know, compared to what happened in the 70s. The book is Panic at the Pump, The Energy Crisis and the Transformation of American Politics in the 1970s. Meg, thank you.
Thank you so much.